Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part two of episode number 105 of my sexy music podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. So first of all, I'd like to welcome all of you to part two of episode number 105 of my sexy music podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. Hi, I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or in iHeartRadio, or in Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is, I'm just going to give you a brief description of what the show is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 24-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a huge sexy music fan slash expert slash nerd. And each week with this podcast, I take one song by one artist from the 60s and split the show in two parts. First part of the show, I talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good or why I think it sucks, then do my own personal analysis on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chords, melody, and lyrics. And the second part of the show, dig deep into the history behind that track. In that part of the show, I talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, who are the musicians on the track, whether it be the session musicians or the band members themselves, and the history behind them, and the history behind the songwriters that wrote the songs, the artist or band that sang or played on the song, and the producer that produced it, and the studio the song was recorded at, the name of that studio and where it was located at, and the history behind the label the song was released on, where that label was located at, the name of that record label, and the year and month the song was released, and the peak position this song made up originally on the Billboard Hot 100 charts when it was originally released. All of that is in the second part of the show. But moving on, let's talk about the history behind last week's artist, which was The Animals, and let's talk about the history behind the song, too, that they recorded. We got to get out of this place, because in this podcast episode, we're really going to be killing two birds with one stone, because we're going to be talking about two completely different things that are somewhat related to each other. And, you know, they really, in this particular song, those two things definitely intersect with each other 100%. And they each have slightly, definitely different histories. But again, you know, those two worlds that are involved within this one song collide with this song completely. And those two worlds and those two completely different things that totally intersect with each other for this song was the British invasion and the Brill Building. And I'm going to spend the first half of the podcast talking about the British invasion, and then I'm going to spend the second half of the podcast talking about the Brill Building. And, you know, because the song was written by two Brill Building songwriters, but recorded by a band that was very much a part of the British invasion. So in this podcast, I'm going to talk about both of those things. I'm going to try not to go super in depth with both those things, because I know that I've talked about the Brill Building on this podcast before. I've recovered songs recorded by these two songs that, you know, that these two songwriters wrote that other people recorded, but it's been a while since I've you know, covered one of their songs. But it's definitely happened before. And it's been a minute since I've done a British invasion band, and the last artist I did, you know, that was a part of the British invasion had a direct connection with the Beatles. But this band really had zero connection with them whatsoever, but they were definitely really, really good. And I figured that now would be a good time for me to talk about some of those other sort of under the radar British invasion bands that you don't really hear too much about, and just talk about the general history behind what was going on in the UK at that time, and you know, how it related to the American scene, and just, you know, what kind of groups were, British invasion groups were around at that time, you know, because really, there were the only really were two kinds of groups, but I'll get into that in just a few minutes. Okay, so basically what happened with the British invasion was that, in retrospect, you know, in the early 60s, you know, the British, you know, the music that was huge in Britain in the early 60s, you know, that was, you know, making the top, literally hitting number one in the UK, in the top 10, top 20, top 30, top 40, the songs that were big in the UK that were recorded by British artists and were written by British songwriters oftentimes never became hits in America. And there's a few exceptions to this. Now, there were some British artists that did manage to have some success in the UK before the advent of the Beatles. And those artists were, you know, the guy that did Stranger on the Shore, Mr. Akerbilk, Kenny Ball and his jazz band Midnight in Moscow, the Tornadoes, Telstar, the Caravels, You Don't Have to Be a Baby to Cry, the Springfield, Silver Threads and Golden Needles. Those were all hits in America by British artists and were recorded in England before the Beatles. But for the most part, you know, the American kids never really heard songs by, you know, Cliff Richard and Adam Faith and The Shadows and Helen Shapiro, all these huge artists in England in the early 60s. They just never really heard them. And I don't know why. Maybe it was because of not so strong distribution with the American labels, you know, getting these singles out from England to America, you know. I just don't understand why there really wasn't that much traction with British music in America in the early 60s. But maybe it was because, you know, at that time, you either had the vocal groups or the male sort of teen idol singer, or the instrumental, you know, bands. There really was no intersection between both of those things. But maybe that's the main reason why there wasn't so much success with British music, you know, in America at that time. But if we think about it, the British invasion kind of got kick-started, you know, just 1 year before February 9th, 1964. You know, because all the bands that would become huge within the first wave of the British invasion, you know, including the Beatles, but also Jerry and the Pacemakers and Billy J. Kramer and Dakotas and Dusty Springfield, they were pretty much for the most part, and the Searchers too, they were all having hits in England, not in America. They were all having hits in England in 1963 before the Beatles came to America in 64. They were all being very, very successful in 63. But in 63, you know, most Americans, you know, were hearing American music. They weren't really getting exposed to the British bands, at least not yet. You know, that music was not really popular in America in 63. But a year later, in 64, is when all hell broke loose and the Beatles came to America. And after that, that was it. You know, but before that, you know, basically, like, it was the songs I've already mentioned, you know, and again, these groups I just mentioned, you know, with the Jerry and the Pacemakers and, you know, Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas and then Dave Clark Five and the Searchers, they all had hits, huge hits in England in before the official start of the British invasion on February 9th, 1964, but they weren't having success in America, you know, before that, you know. And I think this had a lot to do with the fact that the American labels were kind of hesitant to really distribute a lot of these artists. They thought that the British invasion wasn't going to be a long lasting thing in America, that the American kids weren't really going to dig the British artists. But that all changed when, you know, the proof is in the pudding with the Beatles coming to America in 64. And literally after that, it was completely different. I mean, just to give you, you know, a good example, I mean, before 64, most of the Billboard Hot 100 chart and the Cashbox chart had no British bands. But by the time the winter months of 64 came in, you know, the Beatles held, you know, had at least 9 or 10 songs in the top 40. And then, you know, the Searchers had a hit and the Dusty Springfield had a hit. And then you had the Dave Clark Five, and then you had Peter and Gordon and Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas. I mean, and by the late fall of 64, early winter of 65, there was tons of British invasion bands. I mean, you had everything from, you know, the Animals to Herman's Hermits, you know, to Manfred Mann. I mean, just the invasion was here and it was here to stay. And, you know, there was really no turning back at that point. And now I'm going to talk with you a little with you about, you know, the different types of British bands. You know, and again, like, you know, the British invasion wasn't the official beginning of British music having success in the U.S. I mean, heck, I mean, Matt Monroe, who was a British singer, had a hit in America in 61, and so did Lonnie Donegan. He was a British singer. So there was British music happening, you know, being popular in America before the British invasion. But this idea of a self-contained band who were singers and musicians and songwriters who didn't really need, you know, other, it wasn't like a solo artist thing where it was just a producer and arranger and a group of studio musicians and just one singer, you know, or it wasn't like an instrumental band where they didn't sing, you know, and play at the same time. You know, the idea of a self-contained band where everyone played, you know, and everyone sang on their songs, and a lot of bands that wrote their own songs, or at least didn't really cover too much American music, again, that idea was cemented into American pop culture. And then in February 1964, when the Beatles came to America, and then after that, that's really the definitive point of what people defined as the British invasion. You know, the beginning of that was in 1964. Okay, so let's talk about the two really, you know, different types of British bands in the 60s. And there really only was two. I mean, there were some slight variations of this. I mean, this doesn't really count for the solo artists of that time. I'm not talking about Tom Jones or Petula Clark or Donovan or any of the solo artists of the 60s. I'm talking mainly just the bands, the groups, with more than just one member. You know, there really only were two types of British bands that were happening in the early 60s and into the mid 60s. The first type was the blues rock bands. I'm talking the Yardbirds, the Rolling Stones, and them, and the Kinks. Well, I mean, yeah, they weren't necessarily a blues rock band as much as the Rolling Stones, the Yardbirds were, but they definitely were hard rock. I mean, you basically had those bands where they were really rough edge and just super just, you know, not clean and syrupy or really that poppy sounding at all. They were very just raw in-your-face lead vocals, really dominant guitar playing or organ playing. And, you know, and these bands, you know, they absorbed American blues like a sponge. They were huge fans of the really big blues stars of the early 60s and late 50s, like Howlin' Wolf and Willie Dixon and, you know, and groups like B.B. King and all those huge blues stars at that time. They covered all their songs and they were just absorbed with all of it. I mean, the Rolling Stones is a classic example of this. And some of them kind of broke off into, you know, doing their own thing and just, you know, either writing their own songs or recording songs written by British songwriters. So they had that blues thing going on for a while, and then they kind of broke off from that. And the Animals, this particular band was a classic example of, you know, that kind of a band. I mean, the Animals were just a blues rock band to the bone in the beginning. They were really hardcore, you know. Eric Burdon's vocals were just so in your face and just so raw. And it wasn't poppy or syrupy or sappy at all. And that's another thing. The other type of bands that existed, you know, amongst British invasion bands of this era were essentially, you know, almost the bubblegum pop bands. And these bands were not bluesy at all. And sometimes they didn't always play on their own records, and sometimes the producer used studio musicians to fill in for him, but sometimes they did play on their own records, or they used a mixture of both. And those bands included groups like the Hermits and Manfred Mann and Freddie and the Dreamers and, you know, and some other groups as well. I mean, and Jerry and the Pacemakers and Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas. I mean, they were all very much in that pop kind of a vein. And duos like Peter and Gordon, Chad and Jeremy also fell into this category. Again, not bluesy at all. Totally not hardcore, you know, really in your face like the Stones and the Yardbirds and the Kinks and this band, the Animals, were. But again, I mean, the Animals were just, you know, they were so, you know, like Eric Burdon's vocals could literally rip you to shreds. That's how hardcore they were. And the thing that separated the Animals from a lot of the other blues rock oriented British bands of this time is that there wasn't too much of an emphasis on guitar. And yes, I mean, there were some really cool guitar parts in the Animals records, but the guitar was not nearly as important as the compact organ was. I mean, the really, when you listen to those Animals records, right, you know, from the early 60s to the mid 60s, like from 64 on, it's all about that compact organ. I mean, the compact organ is such an important part to those records. You know, it's just so essential. you know, because if you took that compact organ away, you know, you didn't really get the sound of the animals. I mean, there were other groups that had that compact organ sound, like the Dave Clark Five and, you know, Man for Man, but those groups were incredibly poppy compared to the animals. I mean, the animals were so blues rock, and that combination, that really blues rock, raw interface energy, and that compact organ sound really made what people really identified as their own signature sound. And again, I'm going to say this with full disclosure. The Animals did start out as a blues rock band, but like other groups that kind of had that sound in the beginning, they eventually veered off from that. They didn't stay in the blues rock realm forever. They covered pop songs, and they got their sound became more poppy. But you know, that's what they were in the core roots of the band were blues rock. And the thing is that they covered those pop songs with a lot of hesitance. They really didn't want to record pop songs, you know, that didn't represent their initial blues rock sound. They were very resistant to doing those songs, but their producer really made them do those songs anyways because he wanted to give the band a more commercial sound while still they still retained their really dark, you know, in raw interface kind of, you know, sound with the compact organ and Eric Burdon's tough as nails lead vocals. But, you know, now, and basically, you know, the other thing about these bands is that, while, you know, I think one of the reasons as to why the Beatles kind of, you know, rose above all these groups and, you know, still were very, you know, successful, you know, to this day, is that, you know, the band members of that band were so identifiable. I mean, everyone knew who John, Paul, George, and Ringo was. The members of that band were so locked in people's psyche at that time that, you know, they were so irreplaceable that you couldn't really mistake them, you know, when you heard them playing on those records, right? But, you know, with these other bands, you know, they almost, the members of these groups, other than the lead singer, really, were almost kind of faceless, really. You know, because a lot of times when you saw these groups on TV back then, you had no idea who's playing guitar or who's playing bass or who's doing the keyboards or who is the drummer. And a lot of times you just didn't care. You know, really, a lot of these groups, it was all about the lead singer and everyone else was kind of replaceable. And like I said before, a lot of these bands, you know, their images were very faceless. You know, it was a lead singer plus whoever they got, really, as the band, you know. And that's what it felt like with a lot of these groups, because once they rattle off the names of the Animals to you, you're probably not going to know anything about them, really. Unlike if I were to say John, Paul, George, Ringo, I'm like, yep, I know exactly who they are. They have really identifiable faces. I mean, you know, they are the Beatles. And, you know, and other groups like the Animals and Hermits and Manfred Mann and even some other groups. And the Hollies was another British invasion band that came a little bit later. And again, they fell into that poppy sound, that pop rock sound that the Hermits and Manfred Mann, Jerry and the Pacemakers, they fell into that category for sure. And there were some other ones too. Spencer Davis, more blues rock, but definitely more blue-eyed, so I'll talk about them another time. But anyways, you know, these bands, they had faceless members. They didn't really know exactly who they were. And the main thing was the lead singer and everyone else was kind of replaceable. But that there's no denying the talent that was there, because what made the UK separate from America is that Britain was flooded with, you know, self-contained bands that were really competent musicians. They didn't need studio players or outside songwriters. I mean, yeah, a lot of them did use outside songwriters, but the point is that, you know, Britain had a huge scene of bands that, you know, were very self-contained. They, you know, and you can there were really weren't any vocal groups. You know, there were some like the Walker Brothers and the Bachelors, but really it was all about the bands that could play on their own records and were really competent musicians. They didn't need an arranger or anybody like that. You know, they were really, really good musicians on their own without anybody else. And that really attracted American, you know, kids to really pick up their guitars and start a band and actually form their own groups and, you know, not really, and basically do it without the help of anybody else. And that's really a huge consequence that happened because of the British invasion. Because after the British invasion happened, groups like the Bo Brummels and Love and Spoonful and Gary Lewis and the Playboys and all these other self-contained bands kind of showed up after them. Okay, so now let's finally get into the history behind The Animals and talk about exactly how the band formed and how the band really got signed in the first place. But first of all, let's talk about what the original name of the band was, because the band was originally called the Kansas City Five. And the Kansas City Five consisted of members Eric Burdon on lead vocals, Alan Price on organ and keyboards, and John Steele on drums. And the group originally formed in Newcastle. And basically what happened was that Eric Burdon decided to leave that group and join a band called The Contours. And this was The Contours with a K, because I think they probably did this and not confuse themselves as the American Contours. But anyways, Eric Burdon joined that band. And and in that band was a bass player and a guitar player. The bass player was Byron Chaz Chandler, and the guitar player was Hilton Valentine. Well, long story short, essentially what happened was that those two groups formed, and they essentially became, the Alan Price combo. And then they decided, okay, so, you know, the Alan Price combo, it sounds a little too old school. We need a better name to represent our really animalistic blues image. And so they thought to themselves, well, why don't we call ourselves The Animals? And basically the origins behind that name is that Eric Burdon has said in an interview about 7 years ago that he used to hang out with a gang of friends. And one of the friends they used to hang out with, his nickname was Animal Hog. And basically, he decided to name the group The Animals as a tribute to that friend whose nickname was Animal Hog. I don't know what his real name was, but he decided to rename his band just because, not only because of the animalistic, really blues, hardcore image that they have, but also a tribute to his friend whose nickname was Animal Hog, one of the gang friends he used to hang out with when he was hanging out with in Newcastle, England. And basically what happened was that, not long after the band decided to call themselves The Animals, they landed a management deal with a guy named Gregorio Gomelski. And Gregorio Gomelski was a guy that had a lot of connections with a lot of the clubs in London at the time. And, he really believed in the group and thought they could sell well, you know, and do pretty well, you know, in the American market. And by the way, this was kind of, you know, this was shortly before the Beatles blew up in England. This all kind of happened in 62, 63, early 64 is when the group was starting to form. And Gregorio Gomelski became the group's manager. And he got them a pretty steady gig at the Crawdaddy Club, which was in London. And doing these gigs at the Crawdaddy Club, they were able to basically, do a bunch of these really cool blues cover songs by artists like John Lee Hooker and Jimmy Reed and Nina Simone and a bunch of other people, too. But when they were doing all these gigs in places like the Crawdaddy Club in London, they were able to hone in their chops and really get good as a band and start and basically really hone in their roots as a blues R&B band. And essentially that's what happened. And when they were playing at the Crawdaddy Club, they were spotted by a then producer at the time who was an up-and-coming British producer at the time. And just to give you a little bit of a backstory on British invasion producers, there really wasn't necessarily a British equivalent to someone like Phil Spector or Snuff Garrett or an American producer. But there were quite a few really, really talented producers who had their own signature sound in England. And the two that come to mind really are Joe Meek and George Martin. Joe Meek was very experimental and did a lot of weird shit on a lot of really cool records in the early 60s. And he recorded basically out of his apartment building. He was one of the first guys to basically own his own home studio and basically do everything from his home instead of in like a professional recording studio. And George Martin, you know, before working with the Beatles, did a bunch of instrumental string music for EMI. And essentially, he was a very influential producer at the time. And just a quick little FYI, as far as what was going on with the labels at this time, really, if you were a band in England in the 60s, your only options for getting signed to a major label were Pi Records, Decca Records, EMI, and then you had Philips. And those were the four major labels in England at this time, and they all had their own studios. And if you're on Pi Records, you recorded in their studios. If you're on Decca, 9 times out of 10, you recorded in their studios, but sometimes you didn't. And then you had EMI, and then you had Philips. Now, all these major labels, I talked about this before too, they all had connections with independent American labels. So that's how, you know, the American kids heard songs by the Animals and Hermits Hermits and Manfred Mann and a lot of these British invasion bands is, you know, they all the major labels in the UK, the four ones I just mentioned, they all had distribution deals with independent and major labels in America. The most obvious example of this is EMI's relationship with Capitol Records in America. So EMI, which is a huge label in England, who obviously had the Beatles, but also had the Hollies and Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas and Freddie and the Dreamers and Jerry and the Pacemakers and Peter and Gordon, they all were on EMI, but because they were on EMI, they were able to basically get released on Capitol in America. Now, this was before Spotify, so, you know, before the internet. So the only way you can really pure record if you wanted to hear it again after hearing it on the radio is if you went out to a record store and bought the single. And so everything was released on some kind of a label, whether that be an independent or major label. So, you know, before the advent of Spotify and all the streaming platforms, you heard, you know, the American kids would hear a British song on a different label than the British kids would hear the same song. They wouldn't get it on the same label as the American kids would get it on. And, you know, because there was always a difference between the two labels, but basically the same song. And it happened with the Animals, too, because what happened was that they were spotted when they were playing at the Crawdaddy Club by a guy named Mickey Most. And Mickey Most was an up-and-coming producer who was trying to be like a George Martin or Joe Meek or one of those guys. And he would definitely have a lot of success later on. And the Animals was one of the first groups that he worked with personally, you know. And the Animals definitely had a rocky relationship with Mickey Most. But I'll talk about that a little bit later in this podcast. But essentially, Mickey Most, you know, signed them to the Columbia EMI imprint and got them a distribution deal with MGM Records in America. And simultaneously, he also signed another band, which is the polar opposite of the Animals, called Hermits Hermits. And essentially, throughout the Animals' career, you know, starting with House of the Rising Sun, you know, Mickey Most was simultaneously working with both the Animals and Hermits Hermits. And essentially what happened was that, you know, once they had once they solidified the lineup, you know, for that specific, you know, for the Animals, it was time for them to record. Now, the first thing that they ever did, you know, essentially for, you know, for that label, EMI, was a Burt Burns song called Baby, Can I Take You Home? And that was their first really big hit on the pop charts in England. It wasn't really that big of a hit in the UK, but it was definitely a hit. It was a big hit in the UK. I take that back. It was a huge hit in the UK, but wasn't that big of a hit in America. It really didn't do well in America. But then what happened was that then when they had that hit song out, and when it was popular, they started doing clubs. You know, they started playing in places in Newcastle and London. And one of the gigs they did, they heard a guy named Johnny Handel, who was a folk singer in England at the time. And they were basically touring with Chuck Berry. And basically, they discovered this song that they never heard before, but it was this old traditional folk song. And thought, you know what? Maybe this could be a good fit for us. I mean, it's really dark and mysterious and just really in your face and raw. And so you thought, okay, let's see if we can try this song out. Let's see if we can do it. So what happened was that they came up really with their own arrangement for the song, because it was a traditional folk song. So that meant nobody knew who wrote the song, and the publishing for the song was free reign. Anybody who recorded the song and came up with their own arrangement for it basically got all the money for it. I mean, that's how copyright works. You know, with, you know, stuff that's in the public domain, and this song was one of those songs. And they went into the studio, you know, with Mickey Mouse producing the song. And you know, and when they played the song live, the audience went nuts, you know. And that's when they decided to really record it, because they knew they had such a great reaction from the audience. And Mickey Mouse was not really a fan of this song in particular, but you know, the Animals insisted on recording it because they thought it would be a good hit for them. And they went into a studio where they would record most of their big hits in the early to mid-60s. And that was the Langley Studios, which also became also known as Kingsway Studio, because it was in Kingsway, which is a suburb in London, I believe. Yeah, it was definitely in, you know, a suburb in London. But yeah, so they went in the studio to record the song, and the lineup was John Steele on drums, Alan Price on organ, and then you had Felton Valentine on guitar, Chaz Chandler on bass, and John Steele on drums. And by the way, the organ that Alan Price is playing on that record is a Vox Continental. And basically what happened was that they recorded the song in one take. They did the whole thing in one take, and instead of, you know, redoing it, you know, it was decided that the first take was the best one. And it was a 4-minute song, which was long at the time. I mean, it was really, really long. I mean, you know, it was like way too long by AM radio standards in America, and even in England too. I mean, England followed basically the same kind of thing that America was following at the time, as far as the rule of not writing a song that was over 3 minutes, but it clocked in at 4 minutes and 30 seconds. And that was really, really long. And, but the bold thing about this was that when it was released in the summer of 1964 in America, and I believe it came out around the same time in England, it went to number one in America by October of 1964. I think it was like September, October, around that time. And basically, and the cool thing about it hitting number one in America at that time, it was the first British number one that had nothing, that was part of the British invasion, but it had nothing to do with the Beatles. The Beatles had no relation to the song whatsoever. Completely different producer, you know, different studio, different musicians, nothing to do with the Beatles. It wasn't even Lennon McCartney's song. It was just a traditional, like, song from the 1600s, 1700s. And it went to number one in America in, like, September 1964, and it became a huge hit. And all of a sudden, you know, America was, you know, totally attracted to this band. And they were basically became like one of the premier British invasion groups at that time. And shortly before that, the Stones had their first crack at American success with It's All Over Now and followed by Time Is On My Side. So really, you know, the British invasion was in full swing by the time the Animals, you know, made it onto the charts. But they had a number one record with a song that had nothing to do with the Beatles. And that song I'm talking about is the song I was referring to last week, the song you definitely know by this group. And it kickstarted the success of this band, and that song was called House of the Rising Sun. But yeah, I believe MGM actually did edit down the song for the single release of it in America. I think it edited down to like 258, but I believe the version that was universally played on AM radio in America and in England was the 4 minute and 29 second version of it. So the version that was a hit that people heard all over the world for the most part was not the edited down version, but the full length version of the song. And that was the version that this DJ's played, which was pretty risky at that time. But again, it was, you know, DJs were slowly starting to figure out that long songs were cool because then they could go take a bathroom break and they could essentially, you know, take a few minutes to compose himself and get right back on the air. And, you know, and people were starting to realize that longer songs were becoming more acceptable. And, you know, and even though it was pretty airtight as far as keeping songs under that 2 minute and 33 minute marker. But yeah, so essentially when that song came out, and by the way, when the song was originally released, again, it was a traditional song. So, you know, they someone had to get the money. If it wasn't the person, whoever wrote it, and obviously it wasn't because it's a traditional song, nobody knows who writes the song. You know, it's the copyright's basically fallen under whoever writes the arrangement for it. You know, basically what happened was that the Animals collectively came up with the arrangement for that song. It's based on a couple of different things. You know, it's basically their own arrangement, essentially. They pulled from a couple other versions of the song to create their own arrangement of the song. But, you know, one person had to get credit. So what happened was that they were like, look, okay, so, you know, someone has to take credit for the arrangement for the song. Who's it going to be? So what they did is that they listed their keyboard player, Alan Price, as the arranger, but they did this thinking that the whole band was going to get all the money for the song and that everyone was going to collectively, you know, collect the royalties for the song if someone was put down as the arranger of the song. But little did they know that what went down was that, you know, Alan Price was the one who got all the money for his arrangement for House of the Rising Sun because they decided to put him down as the arranger of the song. So he was the one, and that basically upset the band quite a bit. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, even though the Beatles, it was those four guys for most of their hit-making career when they're really big, the Animals were, it wasn't like that. They had a lot of different personnel changes. And one of the first guys that they lost, you know, right when the band was still very much in their prime of commercial success. I mean, after the House of Rising Sun came out, it was number one hit. Then they followed up with I'm Crying, an original song by them, which again, is a song that, which was rare for them at the time. They wrote an original song, it became a hit, it was called I'm Crying. And then boom, 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 boom. And Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. And then it was just, the hits just kept on coming for them after that. But after Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which is basically following into last week's song as far as the timeline as to what songs were recorded in sequential order, right after that song, Alan Price decided, look at guys, I don't want to be in this band anymore. I'm scared of flying. It's just, that's the truth. I mean, I literally, and that caused a problem with the band because they were like, look at man, I mean, if you can't, you know, fly with us, then you can't, you know, record with us anymore. You can't be a part of the band. I mean, you gotta get on the plane to get to all these places we need to get to, you know, for playing live and doing gigs. And I was like, and Brian and Alan Price was like, and basically he said, look it, I don't want to be in this band anymore because I'm afraid of flying. And at that point, it was over. He left the band, and this was right when they were in their prime. I mean, they had Boom 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 Boom, which is a huge, which was a John Lee Hooker song that turned into a pretty big hit in America. And Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, it was a Nina Simone song that they had a huge hit with America too. And, you know, they had all the success going on, and then Alan Price leaves the band, their main keyboard player. But nonchalantly, and basically, like, you know, like, they kind of gaslighted him and said, we'll just get Dave Roberry to fill in for him. And that's exactly what happened. They replaced him with Dave Roberry. And, you know, that wouldn't be the last time the Animals would essentially experience a big personnel change, because there'd be many more after that. But after Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, Then came this song, and this song represented very much a bone of contention with the band's producer and, you know, Mickey Most and this group. But now that we're kind of getting into the history behind the song, let's talk about it and talk about the Brill Building for a minute. Okay, so let's talk a little bit of history about the Brill Building. And more importantly, let's talk about the couple that wrote We Gotta Get Out of This Place. And their names were Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. Okay, so just a quick little recap. I've talked about the Brill Building in this podcast before. I introduced it to you guys pretty early on when I did that Dionne Warwick song run by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. And I've talked about it again with some other songs. I actually did a song, written by Barry Mann Cynthia Weil for this podcast called Kicks, but it's been a while since I've done a song by them. And just before we talk about Barry Mann Cynthia Weil, I'm just going to give you a little bit of a background as far as what was happening with the Brill Building music scene in the early 60s. Okay, so the Brill Building way of doing things worked really, really well. And the success that came out of the Brill Building way of doing things was great. I mean, you had these songwriters who were Jewish, and they would go into these little cubicles and they would write these songs. One guy would do lyrics, the other guy would do the melody, and sometimes it was a married couple, and the girl would do the lyrics and the guy would do the music, or vice versa. And then they would basically record, you know, the demos for these songs, you know, in a demo studio right down the street, and then they would bring the demos to their publishers, and the publishers would pitch their demos to the producers, and the producers would, you know, again, pitch these demos to the artists they were producing at the time. And when they would, you know, listen to these demos and figure out which ones they want to record, they would always make the finished final master recordings of these songs as close to the original demos as possible. They wouldn't really change anything. And, as far as creating the arrangement for it with the full production, with the strings and the horns, the backup singers and everything like that. And that worked really, really well, because the success that came out of that was unbelievable. I mean, the hits by Bobby V and Gene Pitney and Leslie Gore, you know, all those hits that came out of that scene were just incredible. And again, it was a thing where sometimes it wasn't always recorded in New York, even though the hub of the Brill Building was in New York. I mean, you had guys like Snuff Garrett and Phil Spector who were, you know, at the time trying to base themselves in LA. They would go to New York and, you know, listen to demos by New York songwriters and bring them back to LA and produce them, you know. And basically that's kind of how that system worked for a while. And there really was a push and pull thing happening with New York and LA and the Brill Building. And I've talked about that too. I mean, one of the earliest songwriters to have success in that building. And again, the Brill Building was kind of a succession to the Tin Pan Alley and the Great American Songbook of the 30s and 40s. It was kind of the next generation of that. I mean, Lieber and Stoller were based in Los Angeles, and then they moved to New York, and then they went, you know, and they worked there for a long time, you know. So there was kind of a push and pull thing between New York and LA with the Brill Building, but that's besides the point. Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil were one of the top Brill Building songwriters at the time, and they've written probably some of the most recognizable songs to come out of the Brill Building. I mean, just to name a few, I mean, You've Lost That Love and Feeling and On Broadway are some of their biggest hit songs that they've ever written. And they were a husband and wife songwriting team, and at the time, they started out working for Al Don Music, and I've talked about this before. Al Don Music was a company owned by Don Kirsch and Al Nevins, and they basically started working for them, and then Al Don Music was sold to Screen Gems, and they became Screen Gems songwriters, and they did really, really well working for them. I mean, they had a lot of hits. But unlike Carol King and Jerry Goffin and Burt Bacharach and Hal David and Jeff Barry, Nellie Greenwich, Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil never really had the chance to sit in the producer's seat for their songs. They always kind of sat back and just wrote the songs, but they never really produced any of their own songs. And this happened for many of their biggest hits. They always had other people producing them for them. And when you hear their songs, if you listen to the original Barry and Cynthia demos, you'll notice there's always quite a few differences between the demo and the finished master recording. Because, you know, by the time they record the demo, and by the time it was pitched to the artist and producer from the publisher of their song, there would always be some changes made. And this happened because a lot of times they didn't really have a whole lot of say in the production aspect of their songs, you know. So their songs always went through a couple different evolutions. But the main thing to keep in mind about Barry and Cynthia was that what made them so unique compared to other brill building songwriters is that there was always a certain amount of edge with them. They never stuck to the, I mean, yes, they did write some, you know, corny, you know, love songs that were very, you know, typical, but at the same time, they wrote some songs that were slightly, a little bit on the controversial side, a little bit more, they were a little bit more street smart and a little bit more, you know, how do I put this, just almost political, but not really. I mean, more economical in a sense. I mean, if you listen to some of their biggest hit songs like Uptown and On Broadway, I mean, the people that they're writing about in those songs are just poor people, really, who tend to want to have very rich careers. And there's a similar thing with that. I mean, it happens, and you see that, you hear it On Broadway, you hear it in Magic Town, you hear it in Uptown, but, and you hear it with the song too, because again, it has the same kind of, it's the same kind of thing where you have the poor couple who's, you know, who's living a shitty life and they want to, you know, get out of it and live a bigger life. And that was a kind of common theme with a lot of their songs. You know, they always kind of strive for that rich man, poor man kind of a thing going on with their stuff. And it was never, and they never tried to get very political. It was more economical with their song lyrics. But again, it was different from the very sophisticated, as a matter of fact, love songs written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, and the more emotional love songs written by Jerry Goffman and Carole King. And, you know, again, they were really going for that economical, controversial kind of a vibe with their songs. And this song is no exception to that. And let's, okay, so now that we kind of got things out of the way with Barry and Cynthia, let's talk about how this song relates to the British invasion. Because, you know, for a while, like 61 to 63, you know, the incredible amount of success the Brill Building had, you know, on the pop charts was incredible. Millions of songs were able to reach the charts, you know, that were written by Brill Building songwriters. But in once the British invasion happened, I want to say the first 3 or 4 months of the British invasion, there was this assumption happening amongst Brill Building songwriters that their careers were over. And the reason why they were thinking like this was because within the first few months of the British invasion, I want to say 90% of the songs that were, you know, hitting the charts, the ones by Dusty Springfield and Peter and Gordon, Billy J. Crimm, Dakotas, and Jerry and the Pacemakers, they were all basically written by British songwriters without any Brill Building songs being recorded. And at first it was like, oh, shit, man. I mean, it's over. We're done. We're not going to have any more success. We might as well throw in a towel. But then what happened was this. In the fall of 1964, all of a sudden, there was a need for Brill Building songs again by these British bands, because one, you know, they were huge American music fans. I mean, they very much took what they could from American music and kind of put their own spin on it and brought it back to the States. And I've talked about that before. I mean, the amount of American songs these British bands covered is unbelievable. I mean, they did quite a lot. And this band, The Animals, is no exception. I mean, 90% of the songs they did were American. You know, so they really took that American blues R&B sound and just put their own spin on it. So they really were fans of a lot of these Brill Building songwriters. But also the fact that not every single band that worked in the British invasion or that were part of it, they weren't the best songwriters on the planet. I mean, they were really good musicians, but they didn't have the songwriting chops that the Beatles and the Stones and a lot of other groups did. So they were like, okay, these bands, you know, they're not really great songwriters, so we might as well, you know, the producer is like, okay, so I got to find songs for these bands. And, you know, I could turn to a lot of my British guys that I know personally, but I think to increase the chances of success with these groups I'm working with, I'm going to basically, you know, pick up some songs by Brill Building songwriters and have them record it. And that's exactly what happened. Because in the fall of 1964, I'm Into Something Good by Herman's Hermits was a top 20 record. Do Our Diddy by Manfred Mann was number one record. And those are two songs written by Brill Building songwriters recorded by British invasion bands. And how they even got a hold of songs in the first place, again, it goes back to the fact that, you know, like guys like Mickey Most, like the guy who produced his song, would often come in and, you know, take demos, from these, Braille Building songwriters or listen to them, he would make trips to New York and basically listen to these Braille Building songwriting demos, you know, written by these songwriters. And they would bring them back to England and have the groups listen to them and basically make them record the songs. Now, here's the thing that kind of was a problem with Mickey Mouse and the Animals is that the Animals didn't really want to record these songs. They really, really wanted to stick to their R&B blues route. And they felt like the fact that Mickey Mouse was making them record these almost somewhat poppy, but really dark pop. But really, at the time, they were thinking that this is like, you know, we're going way too commercial by recording these pop songs by these Braille Building songwriters. And this is not what we want to do. And we really don't want to do this. And we just want to stick to our R&B blues roots. And Mickey Mouse said, look, guys, you know, you're going to record these songs. I mean, I'm your producer. I'm the one in charge. So you guys don't really have too much of a say in that. And that's what really, you know, that was the bone of contention between the Animals and Mickey Mouse, is that they would make him record these Braille Building songs even though they didn't want to. But they did have massive success with them. But for a minute, let's talk about We Gotta Get Out of This Place, because We Gotta Get Out of This Place was, again, like I mentioned, written by Barry Manson the Awhile. And it was meant to be a follow-up to a huge hit they just scored with the Righteous Brothers called You've Lost Your Love and Feeling. In fact, they wanted the song to be the next single for them. They wanted it to be the next song that they were going to record and have a big hit with. And essentially, that's what they originally wanted to do, right? They wanted this to be the next hit for, for the Animals. For the Righteous Brothers. And they were like, okay, this is going to be the next song I'm going to do. But what wound up happening was that the label that Barry Mann was signed to, they said, look, man, this is a great song. You should record it yourself. And Barry Mann was like, okay, you know what? I think I'm going to do that. I think I'm going to record the song myself and try to see if I can have any success as an artist. So he records the song himself, right? I think he probably did it at some New York studio like Allegro or Dick Charles. Probably not Dick Charles, but maybe, Associated, one of those New York studios. And he records the song himself, right? And, you know, basically he's like, okay, I'm going to release this as a single because I think this could really, really work. And he records the song. And then what happened was that Mickey Mouse, who produced the Animals, actually gets a hold of the demo of the song first, you know, before Barry Mann could have the chance to release this song. You know, basically Mickey Mouse gets a hold of the demo and has the Animals record it, and they release it before he does. And basically his label says, listen, man, Mickey Mouse got a hold of your song, the demo of it first, and had the Animals do it, you know, and they're going to release it. So I don't know if you want to have the conflicting release with your version of the song, the Animals version. And he's like, okay, man, I won't release it. And that's exactly what happened. So he had every intention to basically record the song and have a hit with it as an artist. But what happened was that due to conflict of interest with the Animals, releasing it, you know, before he could and before, you know, they got the demo of the song first, you know, he recorded the song first, but the Animals got a hold of the demo of it and recorded after him, but they were going to release it, and they decided, you know what, I'm not going to release this. There's no point in me doing that now. And before I end this podcast, I'm going to play for you a little snippet of what Barry Mann's version of the song sounded like, because it's quite different from the Animals version. And this is just to show you kind of what their feel for what kind of, writing they could do at this time. And you can really hear how much they really wanted the Righteous Brothers to record the song, even though, you know, it wound up being recorded by the Animals. So this is what the original version of We Gotta Get Out of This Place sounded like before the Animals got a hold of it. Wow. Yeah, I mean, the Animals completely turned that song totally upside down and made a completely different version of the song, you know, when they covered it. And, you know, just the differences are staggering. First of all, the bass line in the song, you know, it wasn't originally played on bass. It was played on piano in the original version of the song. And it's just, there's so many different lyrical versions, differences between the Barry Mann original and, you know, the version by the Animals. It's not even funny, you know. And you can tell that, you know, when they got the original demo, they made so many changes to the song, you know, and they just really didn't do it exactly the same. And, you know, and I don't know if, you know, the Animals should really get co-writing credit for making those changes, but man, I mean, they definitely didn't do it exactly like the original by Barry Mann in the Wild. And, you know, and this is a good example of that. I mean, there were times when the demo was exactly like, you know, the finished master recording was exactly like the demo, no changes. But in this instance, there were some changes made, you know, between the original demo of the song and the version by the Animals. And, yeah, I mean, it was kind of a missed opportunity for Barry Mann, but he had a huge hit with the Animals version. I mean, it came out in the July of 1965, and by September, I believe it was in the top 30. You know, it was definitely a very big hit. It definitely did well for them. And before we move on this podcast, let's do a quick recap on the Animals. Okay, so what happened after the release of the song? A couple of things. One, the Animals experienced another big personnel change. They lost their drummer, the original drummer, John Steele, and John Steele was replaced by Barry Jenkins. And basically what happened was that, you know, they decided they don't want to work with Mickey Most anymore, so they fired him. So after their next single, It's My Life, that was the last song that they worked with, you know, with basically with their main producer, Mickey Most. They fired him after It's My Life and started working with another guy named Tom Wilson. Tom Wilson used to work for Columbia and produce records for Bob Dylan. He produced Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan, and he produced Simon and Garfunkel's Sound of Silence. He produced both those records, and now he's working for MGM and producing The Animals. The first single that they did with this whole new lineup, producer Tom Wilson, drummer Barry Jenkins, keyboard player Dave Roberry, you know, was Don't Bring Me Down, which was another brilliant song written by Jerry Goffin and Carole King. So it was probably one of those demos that Mickey Most picked up when he made that trip to the Brill Building looking for songs to record for Animals to record. It was probably one of those songs that he picked up. So the Animals recorded Don't Bring Me Down, did a really cool version of it. I never heard the original demo version of it, but I think it was quite different from Carole King and Jerry Goffin's original demo version of it. But yeah. So they recorded, they had a hit with that, and that came out in the spring of 66, and it made the charts like, you know, late spring, early summer of 66. And then their follow-up hit was another blues song, a really cool version of C.C. Rider, you know, probably the best, you know, 60s version of it, the best somewhat modern take on the song. They did a really cool version of that. And then something really, really weird happened. Okay, so after this happened, Eric Byrne fired all the original members of the group. Everyone from Dave Roberry to Chas Chandler to Hilton Valentine to Barry Jenkins. Everyone was fired. He got rid of all the original members of the band. And he decided, look, I don't want to work with these guys anymore. And it was probably because they got screwed by their business manager. I don't think they were paid very well. You know, so I think it's probably one of the reasons why they left the band. And, you know, most of the guys, you know, they did okay after, you know, they left the Animals. But the one person who did something of note after he left the Animals, and this is really, really cool. This is something you might be able to relate to if you're someone around my age. Chas Chandler was the original bass player for the Animals, played in all their hits from Baby Let Me Take You Home to this one, C.C. Rider. He later went on to discover and basically become, I believe he was a co-manager for Jimi Hendrix. Yeah, he basically discovered him, and I think he produced some of his, I don't think he produced some of his stuff, but he was definitely involved in the career of Jimi Hendrix pretty early on when he was in England. And yeah, so what happened was that Eric Burton cut a solo album in late 66, and that charted a hit with Help Me Girl. I think Barry Jenkins is playing drums on that. But then what happened was that, you know, when they made the switch from Mickey Most to Tom Wilson, they left the original Columbia EMI imprint and went straight to MGM. You know, they're already being distributed by MGM in America, but they decided to leave the Columbia EMI imprint and just go straight to MGM. And what happened was this, is that After he recorded Help Me Girl, he basically put on a whole new lineup of the Animals. And the whole new lineup of the Animals was completely different. You know, I mean, when you really talk about the Animals, you talk about two completely different versions of the same band. You talk about the 64 to 66 version, which had all of those hits I talked about in this show so far. And then you got to get into the next version of the Animals, which is really called Eric Burden and the Animals. And that group consisted of John Wider, Vic Briggs, and Denny McCulloch. And that group, you know, completely different, definitely more late 60s, more psychedelic rock. San Francisco Mites, Monterey, Sky Pilot, just some of their big hits. I mean, they continue to have many big hits in America with a completely different version of the same band, really. But again, it was more American. I think by this time they were recording mainly in America. I don't think they were recording in England anymore. I think by this time they'd pretty much moved to America and basically were recording there. And this lasted for a while. And then by late 68, what happened was that Eric Burden split off with them and finally broke up the Animals and basically joined War and became the lead singer of them and sang lead on Spill the Wine, which is a pretty big hit for them in 1970. So as you can see, I mean, the Animals, you know, it's hard to have a clear identity of them other than through the lead singer, Eric Burden. And whether or not it's a good or bad thing, I mean, obviously you could say the Beatles are better because it was the four guys from, you know, basically from the, not right from the very beginning, from the beginning of their commercial successful peak to the end of their career. But really, I mean, the Animals are great. I love them. And just because they had a rotating, revolving door of musicians that played in the band, you know, and just because they didn't write their own songs all the time, it doesn't mean they were bad. I mean, they were great musicians. They played on their own records. They didn't really use studio musicians. They were mainly self-contained for the most part. And they recorded really great songs. I mean, again, in a nutshell, the Animals was very much like a blues rock band. They were a blues rock band to the core. They really were against being like a poppy. They didn't want to be a poppy band. They didn't want to be like a Hermits or a Jerry and the Pacemakers or the Hollies or something really poppy. They were a blues rock band to the core, and Eric Burden had killer vocals, and they really did cool songs that could be relatable and almost kind of, it would make sense today because a lot of hard rock bands, you know, if there's any left, I mean, I don't know if there's any left because of the pandemic, but any hard rock bands could easily adapt one of their songs and really do a good version of it. Like It's My Life is a great example of any hard rock band today could do a really cool version of it because it definitely sounds like a modern day hard rock song almost. You know, it definitely has that sound to it. And again, that makes them sound less dated and more, you know, relatable to people in my age group because a lot of their songs are in minor keys. And that's the thing with a lot of today's people. My age group is minor key songs. So again, like, you know, they really had, you know, they really didn't have a dated sound. And, you know, they had that one song, House to Rising Sun, but they had a million other great songs you should definitely check out. And I saw Eric Burden live. It was fantastic. I loved every single minute of the show. We did these really cool extended versions of the songs that he, you know, originally recorded, and he did them all in the original keys. Had great vocals, great musicianship, lots of cool solos played by members of his band, you know, to sort of flesh out the musicianship in his group. I mean, it was fantastic. It was just him, no other members of the Animals, because really, in the Animals, it's all about Eric Burden. He really is the most important part, because literally, you take away Eric Burden, you just get a random band. And I mean, he was the originally essential member of the band. And, you know, and they played him just like the record, so you can say that they were kind of replaceable, really, like all the other members of the Animals. But again, you know, they just were great. They were fantastic. I really, really think they were good and pretty underrated. So that concludes part two of episode one, number 105 of my 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Limbs, and again, I apologize that this podcast went on a little bit longer than you were imagining. I mean, it's funny because I'm over 100 episodes into my podcast now, and they're just, the part twos are getting way more in-depth than I ever would have imagined, but I feel like if you guys have been tuning in since episode one, if you really like this podcast, you'll stick around and you'll listen to the whole thing. And I feel like, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you're doing something around the house or you're walking the dog or doing something where, you know, you could probably dig in and listen to, you know, more than a 30, 45 minute podcast episode. But yeah, I try to keep it interesting, kind of try to keep things moving, try to not make it as boring. So that way you guys can keep listening to each episode of this podcast or listen to the whole thing, even if it's more than an hour. But yeah, so if you found out some really cool, interesting facts about the animals and the song and the couple that wrote it, you never knew anything about them, you can email me at samltwelly@icloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. And also, my website's almost done. It's really, really close to being done. It will be out really, really soon, I promise. I'll let you guys know when it's out. It's really, really close to being done. You'll be able to stream a podcast from there and check out some other stuff as well. I got a lot of stuff in the works, like I mentioned before. Got new music, got my book, you know, a lot of good things I'm working on right now, but I'll let you guys know when that stuff is done. And it's getting ready to get released. So for now, you can check out the official Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. There you'll be able to find, you know, basically all the songs I've talked about on the show so far, including some ones that I've, talked about in interview episodes. And there, and I would appreciate it if you can do that, because then you can kind of get a good idea for what kind of music I talk about on my podcast, including, some songs I've done, talk about interview episodes. And if listening to this playlist gives you any kind of ideas for what kind of music I should talk about next on my podcast, you can email those ideas to me at samltwilliamicloud.com. And you can also, another thing you can do is you can check out the official Redbubble merch store for this podcast. There you'll be able to find this really, really cool merch store that basically has, this my own custom logo for this podcast. It's basically the catchphrase I say at the end of every episode, and keep on trucking, tie-dye font with the name of the podcast on the bottom attached to all these really cool merch stores. Basically you can do that, and you can check it out, and I'd love if you can purchase something from there. But if you don't want to, that's okay. But if you do, please let me know. Email me when you've purchased an item. But if you don't want to, I definitely appreciate the feedback on the prices of each item in the store, plus, you know, what you think of the logo as well. Don't forget to leave me a review in the Apple Podcast app if you haven't already. If you're just randomly listening to this podcast, I definitely appreciate that, and I really would love a review if you take the time to do that. And so I'll keep you guys posted when the book is done, you know, with word transcriptions of my podcast, because I am working on that right now as well, simultaneously with this and website and all that other stuff. And yeah, so if the episode comes a little bit later into the week, or if I might skip a week, I mean, try not to, I'm trying to stick with a specific day where I release, each episode each week, and I'm trying to stick to it. But sometimes things happen. I get busy. I get tied up with doing something, and I don't always get to finishing my podcast. Sometimes a little bit later on in the week. But, you know, I definitely try to get at least one episode out per week. And if I skip a week, it's because I've been doing a bunch of other stuff, and also with this as well. So don't worry. I haven't forgotten about you guys. I'm not trying to, leave you hanging by not putting out more episodes, but I am going to keep doing that. But yeah. So, please keep that in mind, I'm Sam Williams, and thank you for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, please keep things groovy.